You find them?
Yes.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. So out into the next unknown now. This is about JSON web tokens or and the likes. So there is a working group, or rather there was a working group within the IETF called Jose, and the what they were supposed to do was to define an integrity protected object format, and also possibly a confidentially protected object format. That is, integrity means that no one can tamper with it without you finding out that they actually have done so. Confidentiality is about no one should be able to read this unless they really should be allowed to. And also a format for expressing keys. So not using the normal DIR encoding or sort of X500 stuff, X509 stuff, or what, something else. So out of this working group, there came five different definitions. Actually, the first one, the JSON web token, came from the OAuth working group, but it's the basis for whatever was done within the Jose working group. So that's the basis is the AWT definition. On top of that, you then define how to sign such a document or object, and then you define how to encrypt it, and then of course you have to define how to deal with keys. And finally, there are lots of different signing and encryption algorithms, and you have to name them. And you have to say use the same names in different places. So this is a document that specifies the names of different algorithms. To begin with, then, the JSON web token stuff. So it should be compact. I mean, the most compact format I know is probably the JSON one. This should be sort of more readable, but it's not as bloated, you could say, as HTML or XML, stuff like that. It should be URL safe. And there is a reason for that. It's a transport format. And basically, the JSON web token is a set of claims. Now, I'm going to use claims in some places now in the future. And claims is actually attributes. So if you come from the SAML world or LDAP, sort of you used to talk about attribute and attribute values. In this world, it's mostly claims, because it actually is claims. There's someone claims that this is the value of this attribute, but it comes from the from the Microsoft world, you could say. So it's, if you've been dealing with WS sort of family of protocols, you would have used claims. But don't get confused about that. So every time I say claims, think attributes, and it will be fine. So the basis then is JSON, of course. So it's a JavaScript object notation. It's a very simple format. If you have an object, it starts with a, what do you call these? Curly brackets, yes, thank you. And then there's a string, it's a colon, and there's a value. And there can be more of those. And then you end with the curly bracket. Or you have an array, which is a number of values. And of course, you can mix and match these. And you can represent very complex things. So the usage one envisaged for JSON Web Token was that you would use them in authorization headers. And you would use them as query parameters. So that's where they have to be URL safe. But if you want to use them in headers, or if you want to use them in query parameters, they have to be compact. Otherwise, sort of, there is a specific limit as to how big a URL can get. Sort of. And you don't want to reach that limit, so that you want to make it very compact. And you will see some examples of how they try to do that. So a specific liaison web token, if it's is a sequence of URL safe parts separated by period characters. This is still sort of confusing, but you will understand it in a bit. So these are the registered claim names. And here you can see sort of the compactness coming in. So none of these are length more than 3. So you have issue ESS for issuer, sub for subject, AUD for audience, and so forth. So a JSON Web Token should normally contain, could sort of contain these attributes or claims. So, how would you sign these? There is, of course, header parameters. Otherwise, you wouldn't know what you get. So there has to be a specification of sort of what algorithm was used to sign this. Because if you want to verify a signature, you have to start there. If you don't know which algorithm was used, you are sort of, well, in that case, you probably have to try all the ones you know. And hopefully, you would eventually sort of find which one it was. But it's better that someone tells you up front that this is the one that we used. Please verify using the same algorithm. There are two ways of referencing keys. You could either do it by reference, that is, you can say the URL and say the keys I used to sign this document is over there. And you can go and fetch it. And if it's a sort of an RSA key or something like that, this is probably the public part. It's probably not the private part. Otherwise, it would defy the purpose. Or you could actually send the key together with the document, which seems a bit insecure to me, but sort of maybe in some cases it's okay. I don't know. There's also another way of doing it by reference is that all the keys have identifiers. So in some way, you have gotten a number of keys, and now you get something which is signed by the key with the key ID, and then you look in your store of keys and you sort of pick it up, whichever way you got it. There are also a number of ways of referencing X509 certificates. And this is I don't know how many of you have actually been part of doing standardization work. But one thing that is typical when it comes to standardization work is that you have a room where you have a number of people, like this room, and you have to agree on something. But you all come there with a history, and you have a use case. And you want to fit sort of the standard. You want to make the standard sort of fit your needs. So there's a giving and taking. So if you get support for your use case, you vote for me getting support for my use case. And that's why when you look at standard like OAuth, you can see it covers a large area. Because all the people in that working group And that working group has been working for, I don't know, 6-7 years. People come and go also, have sort of added their use case to that. So that's why, even though people were from the beginning trying to stay away from X509 completely, because they defined a new syntax for distributing keys and doing everything like that. Eventually, there was a strong group within the working group that wanted, because they've always used X509 certificates. They don't know anything else. So this was added. It came in at the end. And then there are some information about what kind of information am I sending you, what kind of information is signed, and things like that. And then lastly, you can say that, well, put it this way, these are the headers that are standardized by the sort of the working group. But of course, you could imagine that people are adding other headers. And then if there is an added other header, then they can say that if you don't understand this other header, don't try to do anything with this, because then you don't know what you're dealing with. So this is sort of, if you have a use case in your community, and you add a header for doing something special in that community, you should set it as critical. Because then people who don't understand that header, they shouldn't sort of try to do anything with it. So that's why critical is there. It's also a thing that was added at absolutely the end. So absolutely the simplest YAWT, JSON Web Token, is that you have a header and then you have a message. And the header in this case, if it's unsigned, the algorithm is none. That's how you specify a signature that isn't there. Sort of, I've signed using the algorithm none, which means that I haven't signed it. So there is the header and there is this message. So what's in the header and what's the message? Well, the header isn't just this JSON document, but it's Base64 encoded. So when you want to create the JWT, you first have the JSON object that you create with the claim set. And then you have to make it into UTF-8. And then you Base64 encode it. And you specifically use what's called the Base64 URL encoding, which is slightly different from the Base64 basic encoding.
Is it the same as normal URL encoding?
So there are some characters that can appear in the URL, which is also encoded, Base64 encoded. Because if you use the normal Base64 encoding, there are some characters that sort of would appear, may appear in the URL that is not encoded. Like a slash, I think, for instance. So the message is then the Base64 URL encoded UTF-8 representation of the JSON object. Mouthful, but that's what it is. And then you create the JSON header. Oh, the yacht header, which is then the... So there are slightly different if there is this object is signed or if it's encrypted, but it's at such a header anyway. And then you create the JSON... The yacht is sort of a... It's a name for something that is either a JWS or a JWE. So a JWT by itself doesn't make sense. It's either a JWS, which may be unsigned, or it's a JWE. And then you can have nested things. You can have it first, the message first signed, And then you have the encrypt the signed message, so you can have them nested. Now we're going to see if this is going to work. And then I have to, oh, all right. Sorry about this. Okay. So, I was trying to use, there is a, if you're using Python, there is a program called Jupyter. Actually, it's you can also use it with other programming languages, but this is emanated from using a Python. So you can write sort of code in this, and then you can run it. So you can interactively, so if you change something, you can rerun it and you can have it. You can distribute notebooks, was it called. So someone else who has Jupyter can sort of run exactly the same notebook. Now people doing presentations or demos using this. But anyway, so I just thought sort of I'll try to use it. I've never used it before, sort of in this context. But I thought I'd try to use it. So anyway, this is it. So I've written a library called JWK test, which is of course JWK, JWE, JWS, and JWT, supporting all these different. So that's where the name comes from. And from that library, I import some functions. And then, of course, I have the standard JSON library also imported. So if I want to create a JWS in this case, then I first start by creating the body, the very simple claim set. And this is a method that JSON has that dump to string. So I get text, which is a string representation of this object. This is actually what's called in Python a dictionary. You will hear dictionaries mentioned later also, but because I'm a Python programmer. So anyway, unfortunately then, sort of this is text, which is in Python 3, is, actually it's supposed to be Unicode. That's the default. But this Base64 encoder needs, they can't deal with Unicode, so you have to translate it into bytes. So that is what I'm doing here. So I take this Unicode, I do convert it into bytes, and then I do the Base64 encoding. And I get the message. And then afterwards I do the header. In this case I say that I specify that the algorithm is none. I do the same things, dump it to string, and convert it into UTF-8, not Unicode, and then I Base64 encode it. And then it's simply doing the JWS is just joining these to text, these two Base64 encoded strings, and putting a dot in between them. So the result I get then is this string here. So this is the header, the Base64 encoded header, and this is the Base64 encoded message, and then there is no third part because there is no signature. But there is a representation here that sort of, there should be a third part.
Do you need to recode the Base64 encoded string to Unicode again? Because it is
yes, yes. Because this join here works on Unicode strings. That's why I have to translate them into Unicode again. So that, of course, this is sort of absolutely brutal way of doing that. So you're doing the absolutely basic sort of functionality that you have. Of course, in reality, you don't do it that way, and you will see how. But anyway, if I want to, just to show that this is actually true. So I have the AWS here, and if I split them, and then encoding into UTF-8, and then do the decoding of the base64, I should get the header and the message, and I do get them. So that's the output here. And B here means that it's bytes, so it's Unicode. Now, of course, you rather do something that libraries should actually provide you sort of better tools to do that. So this is what the library I have can do. You instantiate the class called AWS. You give it the message, and then you tell it which algorithm to use. And then you then use a method called sign. There are different ways of signing, but this is the compact way of doing that. So this is the same thing as all these lines above here. But it's a more user-friendly. And I get the same result. And if I decode everything, I see again that I get algorithm none and the message that I entered. So that was the code example. So, now I know how to sign a JSON web token. The next thing is then sort of how do I represent keys? Now we get to encryption later, but I represent keys then. And this is an example. First you specify what is the key type. And in this case, it's something called the elliptic curve. And if it's an elliptic curve, you have to specify which curve you're using. And then there are two parameters together with that curve that specifies the key. These are sort of values that are specific to this key. And then you have a key ID. So that's the full description of the public part of the key, the elliptic curve key. There is a story around this. There is a organization in the US that called NIST, and it's supposed to help the government organization within the US when it comes to security. So they specified a lot of things that then government organization and even private commercial companies doing. And a couple of years back, they decided when elliptic curve was sort of new, there were lots of curves to choose from. So the NIST was asked to specify which curves should be used. So they listed 7 different curves. But there were too many. Because people, of course, the reason for choosing one or the other was sort of local. So they were asked to limit the number of curves. So they said, okay, They limit them to 3. And NIST has very limited resources. I don't remember now how many there are, but maybe there are 50 or 60 persons working there. And they are very good at this, but they are not sort of... There is not a lot of people. So when they chose these three curves, they went to another agency in the US to ask for help. And can anyone guess who that agency was?
NSA.
NSA, absolutely. So NSA told them, well, you should sort of say that people should use the E3. And of course, afterwards, after Snowden, everyone wants to know why those three. Do you know something we don't? So there is lots of work going, there's been lots of work going on since Snowden to find out, without using NIST or NSA, which keys, which curves to use. But this one, the P256, is one that NSA then said was fine. So we don't know. Maybe okay, but who knows? So if anyone has any questions about elliptic curve cryptography, I'm not the person to answer. I'm not the person to ask. So it's pretty neat, I would say. And actually, it's in security circles, it's the thing you should use rather than RSA keys. For several reasons, it's as secure or even more secure, but it also is much more compact and it's fast. It's faster than RSA keys, especially when it comes to encryption. Signature is about equal, but encryption is much faster. So these are JWK parameters. You have the key type. So we've seen an example of. You can specify use. You can say this key should only be are only going to be used for encryption or signing. Again, a good thing to do is not use the same keys for signing and encryption. You should always mint 2 keys, one for signing and one for encryption, at least. If you want to be more specific, there are lots of other sort of things you can specify. I don't think I've seen any use of this, but I'm sure there are use cases. Which algorithm should be used together with this key? So if you want to do RS signing, for instance, you could say it should only be used when you do RS-512 or something like that. Key ID again, and then some added X509 stuff. Of course, when you want to specify your keys, you probably not just have one key, but more than one key. So that's where JWKS comes in. It's an JSON object that represents a set of JWKs. And it's a simple JSON object that has sort of one key, which is keys, and then several values. Yeah, again, using my own code as an example, I have some functions that you can use for managing keys, creating keys, managing keys. I'm sure that so this is my. If you done some sort of web programming, you probably used some cookies, and then you may have a, what's called a cookie jar. So that if you do programming, I have a key jar, sort of similar, some container that contains more than one key. This is an error code that comes from the underlying sort of function, well, underlying libraries, so you just disregard that for the moment. So in this case, I can create RSA key pair. This is the name of the file where it's going to be stored. And then it's normal sort of dir coding, the size 2K. And then I have a class in my library called RSA key. And I can then add sort of these keys to that class instance. There are several ways of doing that. So, in this case, I want to, when I do want the JWK representation, I do what I call serialize it. So I want to have, because I want to have an on-the-wire representation, which is sort of typically what serialize means. It's some text representation or something like that. So I serialize it, and then I do, yeah. So, and it's serialized, it's actually a JSON document. And then I dump it, and I have some things here afterwards just to make it more readable. And here you can see JWK representation of the RSA key. It's the key type is RSA, and then you have the two variables that is sort of defining this key. This is almost always the same. I have never seen sort of anything else used, but there is a possibility to use something else. And then it's the large integer, which is represented as a base 64 encoded long int. I can also represent sort of private keys. This is probably not something you want to send over the net, sort of. But if you want to store it, or something like that, sort of, you can store it in this way. If you prefer that to using the dir encoding. Okay, this is not very pretty, but actually sort of the only thing that you do when you do a JWKS is that you add keys and then you make a list of all the keys you have yourself. And then you just sort of add keys to that list. This is something okay. This is something I use a lot. By the way, I was sitting having dinner yesterday, and suddenly outside there was these 8 police cars, 3 of them black subs, sort of going by like this outside. I wonder if it was some VIP who was going home or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, I have this function I can use, build a key jar. So I specify by a key configuration. Sort of. I can say that, okay, I want one RSA key, and it should be named RSA key. It's going to be used for encryption and signature. I note that I said you shouldn't do it this way, but this is how it's done. And I want two elliptic curve keys from the same curve, and one to use for signature and one for use for encryption. And then I just use this function, and it will create key R for me, and it will create a JWKS. And there is some added information about the key IDs that was created. And the JWKS I got then was the sort of, you can see it start with keys, and then you have the list. And the first key starts here and ends somewhere around here, and then the second key starts here, ends here, and the third starts here and ends here. In a more readable fashion. So those are just text representations. They contain all the things you need to recreate the key on the other side. And it's pretty compact. So that's how you represent keys using JWK. Yes. So as you've seen, sort of the AWS components are the header, a payload, and then the signature. And you have these representations, so you have the header, it's UTF-8 encoded, and you do the base64, and then you have a dot, and then you have a base64 URL encoding of the payload, which should also be UTF-8, by the way, and then you get the signature, which should also be base64 encoded. And you see an example, so there. That. There are actually two ways of serialize a JWS. It's a compact serialization, which is what you have seen so far. And then there are two other ways. Basically, well, it's the JSON serialization, but you can do it in two ways, which are either the general or the flattened one. This is the general, an example of general JSON serialization. So you have the payload, in this case it's the JSON document, you have keys and values. So you have payload, which is the key, and then you have the value. And it's the same as you had when you were doing the compact serialization. So this is the base64 encoding of the UTF-8 representation of the message. But then, when it comes to signature, you can have more than one. So you can sign, and you can split the header into parts, so you can sign part of the header. So you can choose which part of the header that you want to protect. So in this case, what's protected here, if you were to base64 decode this, you would see this would be the signing algorithm used. Just an example. But there may be other things you want to protect. By the way, if you do compact serialization, there is no protection of the header whatsoever. And this is just a text string. Someone can actually go in and modify the header. And the recipient wouldn't know that because it's not protected. So one of the things that there was a group of our security researchers in Germany who did a analysis of the security of OAuth. Now, this is actually one thing they did. So they intervened. They put there were a man in the middle. So they got back one of these compact serialized JSON signed JSON web tokens, and they modified the header. So they switched the algorithm from being RS-256 to being none. And the recipient saw, okay, no signature, even if there was a signature there. And they just accepted sort of everything because it was. Of course, since it wasn't signed, they could also modify the payload because there was nothing to use. So that's the problem when you use compact serialization. There's no protection of the header. So that's one reason for using JSON serialization. Here you can actually protect the header. So in this case, the signature here is of the payload plus the protected part of the header. And you can't see it, but if you were to basically decode it, you would see that this is an RSA, RS-256, and this one is a elliptic curve. So you can see the size differences of the signature, the RSA and the elliptic curve signature. Flatten just means that you can only do one signature. You cannot do more than one. So that's the only difference. You can still divide the header into protected and unprotected parts. But the signature is, you can only have one signature. So it's single digital signature. So one of the things when it comes to standards is that when you read them, there is a number of words that you have to take specific notice of. One of them is must. So there is a difference between what you must implement and what you should, which is something you don't have to, but you really should unless you know what you're doing. So in this case, what's mandatory to implement when it comes to signing algorithms is HMAC, which means that it's a symmetric key signing. It's SHA-256, and then none. So RSA signing is non-mandatory. It's just this symmetric key encryption, which is a bit weak, I think, but that's what they agreed on. It's also recommended that you implement RSA and elliptic curve cryptography, but it's not mandatory. Okay, yeah, so the only difference here from the previous one we saw when it was payload was unsigned. In this case, it's actually signed. Otherwise, it's sort of the same start. Payload is a bit different. I have some more information in there. Otherwise, I say that I should use algorithm RS-512 and sign compact. And then I get this sign JSON. Now, when I want to decrypt this, or rather verify it, I have this sort of a common pattern in when you do programming, you have factories. So I give it the sign, the AWS, and it provides me with an instance of a class that is suitable for that. So it's looking at sort of what algorithm was used and such, and then it provides me with a suitable class for doing the verification. Yeah, so it's not very, it's clearer on that screen than on this screen. Anyway, so I can print sort of it. I get two parts. The part one is the part zero, then, or part one is the header, and the other one is the payload. So I can see that the header is says that the argument should be RS512, and I also can see that the content of the payload is this. This is a string. I haven't done any verification of the signature yet. I'm just looking at sort of what's in there. Because I can do that, because the payload is there. It's just doing base64 decoding. That's one other thing that this German researcher found, that there were lots of implementations that didn't verify the signature. They were happy when they could sort of do base64 decoding, and then they never verify the signature. But in this case, I then do. I use the class instance here, and I do verify compact on that JWS, and I give it the number of keys I think should be useful in this case. So, and luckily, there were one of the keys very useful, and it just returns the verified information, and which is of course the same as I got previously since. The signature was correct. Now, as you can see here, there is no key ID provided, so I don't have anything by which to choose which key to use for doing the verification. This was actually a discussion on the list among implementers just a couple of weeks ago. And it turns out that we have done it differently. So in my case, I just take the number of keys and I go through them one by one until I find one that works. And if I've gone through all of them and none work, then of course nothing works. So I throw an error and say I can't verify this. But there were others that said that, okay, if I have more than one keys that possibly could use for verifying that, I will try the first. If that fails, I'll stop. And the reason for doing that, they said, was these keys, there could be hundreds of them. It will take forever if I'm going to go through all of them, sort of, and trying all of them before I've hit the one that actually does it. So, depending on which library you use for doing this, you may have different behavior, which is slightly problematic, but that's how it is. The reason why there may be more than one key is that if the other party is doing key rotation and never removes any keys, so it just adds keys. One of the design criteria when it came to OpenID Connect was that it should be easy to rotate keys. And in fact, there are some services that demands that you rotate keys every 24 hours. And the reason for doing that is not that they need to do it, but they want to find entities that can't cope with rotating keys as soon as possible. So it's better to find it after sort of 24 hours than after like 3 months or something like that. Okay. EAWE then. So it's the same headers as the for the signing part, except for they added two things. One is the encryption algorithm, and the other one is the compression algorithm. Now, a compression is, of course, compression. That's not difficult. If you zip it or whatever you do with it. But what's the difference between algorithm and encryption algorithm? Well, it's the same as when you do the if you use HTTPS. If you use HTTPS, the client and the server, they have their keys. But they are using them, they create a temporary key for one communication. It's one communication session. And that key is transferred and protected during transfer with using sort of with the keys they have that you provide sort of your web server with or something like that. But the communication is encrypted with this temporary key. So you have one permanent key which you use to encrypt a temporary key, which you then use to encrypt the information that you are transferring when you're in the communication. So ALG here is the encryption algorithm for encrypting the keys, the key, the specific temporary key, while ENG is the encryption algorithm used for encrypting messages sent between the parties. So this should be, this can be a slow algorithm, it can be slow to do that because you're only doing it once, it doesn't matter. But it should be extremely secure. This should be fast because you have to do it a lot. And you could possibly sort of make it a bit less secure, but it has definitely to be fast.
Is it tip to pay a CVC cipher with the encryption algorithm?
Yeah. Absolutely. So in the components in the AWS, there were three components in the AWE. There are actually, there can be five or six, actually. So you, again, you have a header. Here you have the encrypted key. You send, you may have an initialization vector, which is then used when you are creating a new key. This additional values are can be there or it may be missing. You have the ciphertext and then you have an authentication tag. Lots of things. Support for encrypted JWTs are optional. So no one has to implement it. And there is, but if you do it, then you should implement these two, the RSA PKCS1 version 1.5 with and so forth. So there should be some commonality then between the implementations. What? So in this example, I took this from the RFC. So there, the example is a text string. It's not a JSON document. But again, it's sort of similar. You have, in my case, sort of you have a class instance. You specify the message, which algorithm you want to use. And so this is the algorithm you used for encrypting the key, and then the encryption algorithm you're using, that, which is the CBC type algorithm for encrypting the messages. And then in this case, I give it some key to use, and then sort of encrypt. And then I get, in this case, 5 different parts. It's not so very useful to look more at that, but decrypting is as simple as giving it the encrypted message and a key to use, and then say decrypt. And after the decryption, I got sort of the same text as I entered, so it should be okay. Just to show that my library also can do other types of algorithms, I use 2 other algorithms for specification for doing the encryption, and these 5 parts are different, but okay, you don't see that. But I get the same. I could decrypt. I was provided with a specification, that is the document and some key, and it will figure out all sort of and decrypt it, and I get the message at the end. You don't see that here, but the notebook is actually running sort of and doing this now. So you're not something, you don't see anything that I've sort of done a week ago, and but you see it right now. It's one of the neat things with using this. I can clear out all output and then sort of rerun it. The last thing is then this algorithm that's specified, and it's just a number of strings representing the different algorithms. I don't think so. And those are the links. So that's part of it, and that's it. Probably should take a short break now. But I think we'll get back in, say, 1:45, and do some more on the next slide set before we take lunch. You should stand up and move. You know, you may not have it, but I have a sort of an Apple Watch, and it's programmed to 10 minutes to full hour. If I've been sitting for 50 minutes, it starts to poke me and say, "Stand up, stand up, stand up." Are the stuff here already?
It's not, but I think it will arrive shortly.
Right.
I will ask, but I asked Rabin, so...
Otherwise, right, otherwise we can start in a few minutes and then run another half hour or something like that.
Jó, 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 jó I don't want to comment it.
Ez már hosszú évek alatt itt is. Ez nem volt. 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 Nem volt
Okay, we'll do a couple of more slides before lunch. I think that the last part about signing an encryption is absolutely the dullest part of this presentation. It's like always with security, it's terrible. You don't want to deal with it. Until you're hit by sort of a problem, then you think, oh, I should have spent some time on this, but then it's too late. Anyway, so OAuth was published as RFCs, and then, of course, immediately there were people starting adding things. Actually, there are a number of, so JSON Web Token was sort of published at about the same time. Actually, the threat model and security considerations was published before, or roughly the same time period. That's interesting because they tried to go through all the problems that may happen. So they specify that the bad parties sort of have unlimited resources, unlimited time, and that the bad guy actually controls two out of the three partners. So it may control the authorization server and the resource server, and then try to fool the client. Or they may try to, control the client and the authorization server, and may try to fool the resource server. So how to deal with that? So they go through all these different variants and sort of what may happen now. Of course, it turns out that they missed things. So there actually are a couple of security issues they didn't catch, but has been published afterwards. And it's sort of interesting. I was at the meeting in Frankfurt outside Frankfurt. This is in December 2015. And there was these German researchers who published sort of their finding on the problems they found with OAuth and OpenID Connect. And there was this group of people, like there was a dozen or something like that, sitting around the table. And we all agree this is a problem. But then comes the problem, how do you publish this? So some of the people that were there were representing sort of implementations like mine. So I could go sort of and during the evening sort of actually fix my implementation so it covered these problems that you found. But there were lots of implementers who weren't there at this meeting. So of course you first want to go to them and tell them there is a problem. You should fix your implementation. You should fix your libraries. And then go public. But how long are you supposed to wait for them to fix it? So eventually, sort of, these guys actually published this at conferences. But it was like half a year after we got to know sort of their findings. And that's a continuous problem when dealing with security, is how do you spread the information about the problems? Another thing that one immediately discovered was that the authentication and authorization grants, one could do things with that. So one thing, of course, was people wanted to use SAML assertions for as an authorization grant. And then, of course, one wants to use JSON Web Tokens. So there was a specification on how to do that. It's sort of the general. So if you want to use the assertion as an authorization grant, you will use these new parameters with a grant type. There is a new value for grant type. So its grant type is SAML to bearer, for instance, which means that it's a SAML assertion. And then the assertion as such, you just add its base 64 and omit it for brevity, of course, because otherwise it was like just continue out to the next sort of building or something like that. So that's if you want to use this as the authorization grant. So this is not, you won't get the code, but instead you will get sort of something that is specified to be a SAML assertion. So the recipient actually knows this is something I can unpack and understand if I understand SAML assertions. Likewise, if you want to do it, you can also use it for client authentication, which is another example. In this case, it's not a SAML assertion, but it's a SAML bearer, call it. So it's slightly different, but it's sort of the same ID. But here you use it to get an access token. Here you use it to prove that the client is someone you should talk to. And the JSON Web Token sort of in the similar manner. So now suddenly sort of the bearer token is not an opaque thing anymore. It actually is something that contains information. So there's been an ongoing discussion about sort of should then the thing that you send, should it be signed? Is that enough? Or should it be encrypted? And there are people that say that you should never send them in clear text or sign, or you should always do encryption. But then all the libraries doesn't have support for that. So that's another problem. So that's that side. Another thing that also immediately became clear was that you need support for dynamic client registration. This is represent another pattern, because the OpenID Connect standard was actually published before the OAuth standard, which is a profile of, which is sort of strange. So when we published the OpenID Connect standard, we couldn't reference the RFCs, the OAuth RFCs, because they didn't exist. So we had to reference sort of late drafts. But one of the things that OpenID Connect added was dynamic client registration. So it, after a while, then became retrofitted into OAuth. So one took the OpenID Connect specification and then retrofitted it into OAuth. One made some slight changes to that. And one thing, for instance, is that when you do dynamic client registration in OpenID Connect, and actually we'll mention this later on, you cannot modify the registration. You cannot delete the registration. You can do a registration, but then sort of, if you want to modify the registration, you have to do a new registration. So part of the deal here is that the server should allow a dynamic client registration, but limited in time. So you may register a client, and the client is valid for a day or a week, or something like that, but should be limited. And then you have to re-register. This one, though, in OAuth, allows you to modify the registration and delete the registration. So that's one thing they added that OpenID Connect doesn't have. This also came out of sort of missing early things. There is no I talked about this sort of that the authorization server could make an access token or refresh token invalid, but I sort of hand waved around how that happened. So there is no one who could. There was no way of using a standard protocol way sort of doing the token revocation, but now there is. So in this case, sort of the client can demand, for instance, that the token is revocated.
Is it some form of logout?
Yes, you could possibly see that as that. In OAuth, yeah. Because there is no other way of doing that in OAuth. In OpenID Connector, there are other ways of doing that. But in OAuth, no. Yes.
So the client requests the token to be revoked.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the authorization server can do the revocation.
Yeah.
On its own.
Yes, yes, exactly. And then, of course, this becomes interesting, token introspection. And that's actually pulling apart the authorization server and the resource server. So now they don't have to be closely linked and sort of have the same database, background database, as I said earlier. In this case, the resource server can give the token to the authorization server and ask sort of, what can I do with this? What does it mean? And get back sort of the information about sort of the scopes that is valid for, when it was issued, how long it's supposed to be valid, and things like that. So now the token can actually be opaque. It doesn't contain any information. No one can interpret because the resource server can ask the authorization server, what is this? What's it supposed to be used for?
Wasn't that included in the response that is sent to the client by the authorization server?
Yes, but not to the resource server.
I see. So the client hides this information from the resource server? And by using that RFC, that resource server can query the authorization server directly.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And also it's a way, of course, for the authorization to say that, okay, you have this token, but it's not valid anymore. So that's part of it. So not just saying sort of what can it be used for, but also whether it's valid or not. Which makes sense.
What is the right way to handle this? So
there isn't any right way.
Okay, but is the best way? Okay, there is many ways.
There are many ways. It depends on the use case. Actually, I mean, if you're in a closed community, and there is a close connection between the authorization server and the resource server, you don't need token introspection. If you're in an environment where you're using SAML for authentication, then using SAML authorization to send around as code may make the sort of sense to do. If you're not in that kind of environment, maybe it's not. And then, instead of having a token introspection endpoint sort of supporting that, you can actually send around a JSON web token which contains all the information, so you don't need this. So it's just it's sort of a use case dependent, which one you want to do.
Can I have a question?
Yes, you can have a question, just one.
Because I'm trying to...
And you can have the mic.
All those things. And
you get the access token.
And I'm wondering whether OAuth 2 is actually a really physical protocol or set of protocols, or it's rather on a conceptual level. It's
yes.
An idea.
Yes, you get it. Yes. It's a framework. So it's like a net, fishnet sort of. There's lots of open areas.
Okay. So specific implementation would bind those this idea to some, I don't know, HTTP, for example, actions, right?
Right.
But at this level, this is a rather an idea, concept, set of rules, and so on.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, we talked about, we had this, I made this test tool for OpenID Connect for verifying implementations. And that's possible to do. Do the same for OAuth isn't possible to do, because there are so many empty spaces, you could say, in the specification, that you can't sort of verify the implementation. So that's, you need profiles. So another thing that one discovered was the problem with bearer token. So there were different ways of getting around that to prove that you have been giving this token, been given this token, and you are the one who should be able to use it and no one else. So this RFC 7636 describes how to do that. It has a name, and you will probably hear that. It's called Pixie. So if anyone talks about Pixie, it's PKCE, Pixie. So, you know, this is what they're talking about. And I will show you more example of how it's done later. But it's about proving that you are the one that got the access token and should be able to use it, and no one else should be able to use it. So what happens is that if you do Pixie, is that the client creates a secret, code verifier, and you have a transformation function. And you use that transformation function on code verifier, and you get something called code challenge. What you do then is, in the authorization request, you send the code challenge and you send information about what transformation method did I use. So you send the result and the transformation method. Then the authorization server then, of course, stores those two values. And then when the client sends authorization code to the access token endpoint and request, it includes the code verifier, this original value that was transformed to produce code challenge. Now, since the authorization server now knows sort of the initial value, and it knows the transformation function, it can then compute a value, and it should be the same as the code challenge. So now it knows that when it talked to this client regarding authorization request, it's the same entity that now speaks to it when it talks to the token endpoint. So as an example, you send the code verifier and the challenge, or you construct the code verifier, which should be amplified sort of string. And then you have a method, in this case, is a hash function. And you do the hash function on this value and get the code challenge. You send that in the authorization request, and then later on in the token request, you send the code verifier, and then the authorization server then has all the necessary pieces to verify it is the same entity is talked to. So that's one way of proving that it's the same entity that you're talking to. Another way is called proof of possession. It's slightly more, and this is sort of abstract way of describing this. So you don't have client and service and so forth here, but it's should be sort of the same. Or you can, this is sort of the abstract way of describing this, but then you can, of course, should be able to apply that to OAuth. But here you have an issuer that the presenter, which is normally the client, talks to. The issuer, in this case, has some relationship to the recipient, which should be the authorization server in this case. So they have exchanged keys. So they have a common key. Say it's a symmetric key. Doesn't matter, but say it's a symmetric key. So what this guy does is either he creates a symmetric key or this guy creates a symmetric key, and it encrypts, it makes a JWE with this key in it, proof of possession key, using this key that it has in common with the recipient. And then the presenter sends this JWE to this guy. And now what's not describing here is that there should be some kind of challenge here. So this guy should send some value to this, and this guy should use this key to encrypt it and send it back. So this guy knows he has the key, and it's the proper key because it was signed or encrypted, in this case, by this issuer who I have a trust relationship to. So there are things that are left out here, but that's the basics. So this guy's prove that, well, they have a key, symmetric key that is signed by this key. And to prove that it's the same key as this guy has, there has to be a challenge response part here. Yes, it could be. Yeah, of course. Yeah, in the AWE. Yeah. When it comes to symmetric keys, then this guy is minting the keys. So this guy isn't minting the keys, but otherwise it's sort of the same. Sends the public key to the issuer. The issuer encrypts it, sends it back, the AWE, which is then included in the request it's sent to the recipient, and together with some other stuff then to prove that the presenter has the key, and then this guy can verify that the key that presenter has is the key that the issuer have signed or encrypted. So then it's one part of this RFC 7800 then is to describe how these keys are represented. And they define something called CNF. And there are several ways. So here you can have an encrypted symmetric. Here you can have a JWK sort of in clear text. The key ID, or even a URL where you can fetch the keys and the key ID. So there are several different ways of representing the key here. All this to fix these problems that the authorization server must be very certain that it's talking to the client it should talk to. And it should be mutual trust, so the authorization server should know that it's the proper client, and the client should know it's the proper authorization server. So that's basically sort of what was discovered after OAuth had been released, that there were lots of issues around that, sort of the different parties knowing that the other parties were the correct parties. I think we should take lunch now.